Step into a world where ancient wisdom meets modern mysticism. Introducing the Gnostic Tarot, a powerful fusion of esoteric art and Gnostic themes designed for those who seek the ultimate gnosis. This mesmerizing deck, rich in symbolism, draws from the profound teachings of Gnosticism, serving as an ideal companion for meditation, reflection, and the exploration of spiritual realms. Whether you are a seasoned tarot enthusiast or new to the practice, the Gnostic Tarot caters to all, offering a portal to ancient wisdom and a tool for uncovering the hidden truths in your mystical journey. Unveil the mysteries, embrace the wisdom. The Gnostic Tarot is a timeless companion for your spiritual odyssey. Take a journey with Gnostic luminaries and learn their stories in a visually stunning manner. From Sophia to the Gnostic Christ, their journey is your self-discovery. Choose from the basic deck or the deluxe version, which includes a beautifully crafted journey book and a magnetic storage box, ensuring that your Gnostic Tarot remains a treasured companion on your spiritual quest. The Gnostic Tarot is an original and collaborative effort between Miguel Connor of Aeon Byte Gnostic Radio and Matthew Schmitz of Altrusian Grace Media. Visit our website to embark on your journey today. Synkrasis Publishing, where ancient wisdom and modern mysticism converge. Welcome, everybody, to Aeon Byte. Welcome to this ball of confusion, but that's where the world is today. And the band played on. And don't ask me why. I was listening to that old Love and Rocket song, and I'm looking at the lyrics and going, oh my God, this world has not changed. If that doesn't mean we're not in a simulation or some sort of totalitarian government, I don't know what is. There's still war in the Middle East. Middle class is going to hell. Nobody's feeding the poor. The world has not changed since that song, but the solution is always the same solution. That is gnosis, the inward journey, finding out who you are and what your purpose is to heal the world and make contact with higher worlds to bring back that healing energy and waking up even more. So my name is Miguel Connor, your Love and Rockets, your Pompidus of Gnosis. And so happy to see people today on Saturn Day here. I hope everybody's having a good weekend. And I already see plenty of people going into the chat. Good to see everybody. Kill your egregores, John Macklin, Alexander, and everybody else. And today we definitely have a great special Sabbath show because I'm very excited to once again be hosting Darren Lorente Bull to discuss his new book, Searching for the Divine Spark, A Brief History of Gnosticism. Darren, thanks for coming on the show again.
Thank you very much for having me. 7 years, or at least 7 years since the last time I was in the virtual Alexandria, so it's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Really, that long? 2017? Yeah. My God, time
2017,
flies.
I think, yeah. That's wow. Yeah, that's too long. When I wrote my book on Freemasonry.
Yeah.
Time flies.
It does. Yeah. Again, speaking of Saturn, he's not kind. You blink, and here we are. Oh well, it's meant to be, and we should, as I say on the show, don't forget about this linear time stuff because it is the trap of the demiurge. It's one point in time, and here we are with that eternal gnosis. And with us, too, we've got Graham Pong. Graham, how are you doing?
Very good. And a longtime Love and Rockets fan, and I always loved that they were They were just updating the story from the 60s that the Temptations told.
Yeah, that is true. So you think the world's getting better, or is just it's the same damn hologram, Graham?
my guess is, as I'd like to say, you know, history doesn't repeat itself; it echoes. And yeah, I'll be glad when the echoes settle and something else takes over.
Okay. Yeah, good luck with that. Don't wait.
Jump on the Kundalini Express.
The Ouroboros. Yeah. You think it's you're all up, in your and mind. All of a sudden you're down at the bottom of the coil. So it is. So it is. Yeah. And for everybody in the chat, again, good to see you. If you have any questions for Darren, please super chat them or insults for me. That way we can separate them and get to them. Darren might be looking at the chat. So if he sees something you want to address, that is his decision. Other than that, not much housekeeping. As always, you saw the intro for those of you on video. Please get the Gnostic Tarot. Feedback has been amazing. Wizards and magicians and witches are having great results with it. Don't forget the Astrognosis Conference, August 9th and 10th. Almost done with the guest list, and we'll have the calendar and all that soon in the coming months, but you still can get your early bird tickets before the end of April, and it's $20 off. Not much else on the news report. Great shows coming up. Beyond this, great show, and I will keep you abreast of all these shenanigans. So, Darren, let's start with you and why you decide to write this book. It was first in Spanish, right?
That's right. I wrote it through the years of the pandemic, which gives you a bit of a, you know, special. I had the time to actually write and research on a subject that was always been very dear to me. So yes, it was first written in Spanish, published by Ray Small Publishing House in Spain, Ediciones Matrioska. It was always important for me to translate it into English, and I thought that it would definitely have more of a, you know, be probably have more chance of being read in English. And since I put quite a lot of effort into it, I thought, you know, be foolish of me not to translate it. But of course, that's another job in itself. So translating it from Spanish to English was quite a chore. Even though we've got all these tools nowadays, like Google Translate, obviously the nuances and the jargon of Gnosticism don't lend themselves very, very well to all of that. So it was hard work, but yes, it started off in Spanish, and I've just recently published it, self-published or via Amazon, in English. So yeah, I'm quite happy with the result. I still think I can improve a bit more, but you know, I think for now it's the finished product.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot as we were talking. I love these sort of introduction books of Gnosticism that give you the snapshot and take you on the Gnostic saga. And there are great ones, but the problem is that they can be a little dated. Don't get me wrong, these books, 80% is right, but then there's that 20% that you want so that people know exactly where we are, how Gnosticism is manifesting in today's society. So, for example, Sean Martin and Andrew Philip Smith put out good, great books on Gnosticism. Again, short, great reads, but that was like 10, 15 years ago. So it was a good time to put this book. So I would tell the audience, check it out for sure, because, again, it's something you can read on the weekend and you'll get a good snapshot and summary of the Gnostic philosophy from ancient times to today. And always good stuff. Good stuff, man. I'm glad you wrote it. It was a good time to write it or put it out.
No, thank you very much. My interest in Gnosticism started quite a long time ago, and hence the dedication to yourself and Saint Augustine, which, you know, it's a bit weird, I suppose, when you saw that. But I think, you know, when I remember I was at university and I was I read the English in the late 90s. But of course, that was more like, contemporary, you know, 20th century French philosophy, structuralism, right, and post-structuralism and all that stuff. So in order to have a bit of a break out of, you know, simulacrum and signifiers and signifieds, I stumbled across Saint Augustine's Confessions, which I quite enjoyed.
Beautiful work.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, St. Augustine is a very interesting character. And of course, when I discovered that he'd been a disciple of Mani or a follower of Manichaeism, I thought, wow, this is really interesting. I mean, he's a founding father of the, you know, established church, yet, you know, he belonged to this strange you know, Gnostic religion, I dare say, rather than philosophy, which I think probably Manichaeism was a religion in its own right. And then when I was initiated into Freemasonry, that's when I stumbled across Gnosticism again. Very on the sidelines. It's not something that, I mean, I think that Freemasonry is probably more, owes more in its makeup to Hermeticism. It's a more of a, you know, positive, shall we say, road than, you know, Gnosticism, which unfortunately can be a bit of a dark road. But again, I did come across that, and I did, you know, obviously many of these old 19th century scholars of early scholars and writers of Gnosticism were Freemasons. So I think it's always, and of course, Gnosticism is something that's, I think, accompanied the whole thread of the Western mysteries since, you know, ancient Christianity until today. But the thing about Gnosticism, of course, is that it's gone through all these different stages where, you know, it's maybe by proxy, but it's certainly got some links with Hermeticism through Platonism. It's got some links with Freemasonry, with alchemy, with all the occult tradition. But then nowadays, and I suspect, right, I do believe that it's, you know, things, you know, thought experiments like the theory of assimilation by Nick Bostrom, the idea of transhumanism. And again, transhumanism is I wouldn't say it's Gnostic, but I would say it shares some of the aspirations of Gnosticism. It's a kind of materialistic Gnosticism. It seems that it's more in vogue than it ever has been. I mean, I think it really, and I think your show is a testament part to all of this. You know, how many years you've been online now?
Oh, many years. I don't even want to think about it. I start feeling even older.
But this is it. I mean, so you know, I think 20 years ago, most people didn't know what Gnosticism is, and I think now it's something that's it's far more, you know, at least it has become something a bit more, people are more aware of it, or it's more accessible, you know, which is a great thing, because it's I find it it's an endless road for, you know, all sorts of speculation, thought, debate, philosophical inquiry, metaphysical inquiry, and it just seems to merge with it's like some sort of virus. I don't know, it mixes up with everything, with religions, with philosophical ideas, with even with science. It is a very, very interesting and fascinating field of study, that's for sure.
Oh, indeed. Maybe it's like the plasmate of Philip K. Dick. But no, I agree with you. Well said. I would say, yes, Freemasonry is a more solar movement. So that's probably why you like Gnosticism, because you're like, hey, man, I need my lunar stuff too, right? Or else I can't be whole. But even stuff like, I mean, how it's changed, and I want to talk to you about that. Even something like Rosicrucianism, people were like, well, Gnosticism has nothing to do with the Rosicrucianism. But as scholarship advances, people are realizing that healing, soul healing, body healing is integral to any Gnostic group in ancient times. So, and what are the Rosicrucians about? Healing the nations, healing the world, all that. So there is a connection that people didn't see. And then, like you said, the simulation 15 years ago, even the books that I talked about, they don't really talk about it. The world has fallen, all that. If you mentioned simulation, you were considered some edgelord, some fringe guy. Maybe Anthony Peake might be making the connection. But now it's like you said, Neil deGrasse Tyson says it's probable. Elon Musk, you know, when you do the numbers, there's a high 90% chance we are in a simulation. And whether the coders of the simulation are us or some bad guys, you know, we don't know that, but we're getting closer. So that idea has become very mainstream. So many other ideas of the Gnostics, again, have caught on.
And of course, it's the fact that consciousness is the most important aspect of our condition as humans. That's a fascinating thought in itself, particularly now in this great materialistic age we're living, and where things, you know, and on mainstream established religions have perhaps lost their edge, I think, sometime now. So you know, we need a new religion for the new eon, I don't think that's exactly going to, I personally don't think that was Crowley, and I think Crowley's got really nothing to do with Gnosticism, but I do think that his ambition to create a new religion or a new metaphysical inquiry, a new way of looking into these mysteries, the mystery of our existence, it's essential. I think Gnosticism has got so, look at it from it kind of merges with some scientific, not directly, of course, but you know, even in science and philosophy, Baudrillard, held the great priest of postmodernism, rationalist, very much part of that milieu of 20th century French philosophy. Yet he wrote the poem about Mani when he was young. Yeah. And he was very interested in the Cathar movement, obviously being French, is a big thing over there. But of course, you know, he in his book Simulacrum and Simulacrum, he talks about images and how, you know, copies of images that, you know, we've got an image or we've got or a symbol, we could say, and we could say, okay, this is a real version of the real thing. But then, you know, as these copies are made out of new copies, and we could go back to the emanations, aren't they, really? The emanations, yeah, just, you know, diffuse and deteriorate and change completely the original meaning of reality, the original, you know, subject of the whole thing. So yeah, I mean, the ability that Gnosticism has to merge with any field of inquiry, be it religion, be it philosophy, be it science, is quite fascinating. You know, there's these links with quantum physics, again, nothing direct, but it really has this ability that I think no other field of inquiry, of human inquiry, has. And you can take it as literally as you want, of course. And of course, the gnosis, there is gnosis, is not really gnosis, as they say. I mean, you know, we've got Elaine Page now telling us that, and I think she's right. I mean, you know, that really most of these texts that we consider Gnostics, or most of these groups that we consider Gnostics, particularly the ones with a Christian affiliation, are not really Gnostic. They're just different forms of Christian belief in the early ancient days of Christianity. I find that fascinating as well, because is Gnosticism, is Christianity a sub, is it part of Christianity? Is it just shall we say, a subgroup within Gnosticism? Again, we look at Sufism, we look at every single established religion has got its Gnostic fringe side to it, but what's really fringe? That's what sometimes I wonder. What is really fringe? Is it the religion itself, or is it their Gnostic so-called fringe side?
Yeah, it's like Peter Kingsley once said, no, Gnosticism is not a Christian heresy. Christianity is a Gnostic heresy. You can flip it around, and you know, it's where you're standing. But I would just disagree with Pagels about Gnosticism being an alternative Christianity. But that's just my stance.
But I think what she said, obviously you can't, I mean, you know, the Sethians and the Essenes and all the all those, shall we say, non-Christian groups. Well, obviously that we could call Gnosticism, you know, I think. But when we look at Valentinus and we look at Basilides, is just completely wacky that to think that he's considered, or he's self-professed Christian. But then Martian, I mean, again, are these Gnostics? Are they Christians? The Gospel of Thomas, now there's, I believe the debate now with the Gospel of Thomas is that it's not really a Gnostic text. But I do like what David Brackey says, and he says that it is Gnostic, but it's in its own alternative format. It presents an alternative, it's just doesn't, right. There's no Gnostic terminology, but the format, the way and the ideas are very much Gnostic. And of course, why was the Gospel of Thomas not included in the canon? Well, I don't know the reasons, but I mean, obviously, it would have made perfect sense to include it. It does say in one of the logias, it says something about Christ being the Son of Man and just being a man, which you could interpret as being kind of, pseudo-Docetist, on the lines of, on the fringes of heresy. But then on the other hand, I think it's Logia 55, I think it talks about taking up your own cross. So, and you can understand that as you wish, I think. The reader can take from that what they will. This is a text that can be, I think, perfectly read and accepted by mainstream Christians, as well as by Gnostics or by any person with a spiritual interest, like one of the great sacred spiritual texts. I think it transcends all religious, barriers. But at the same time, it could perfectly have been, the fifth gospel in the synoptic ones in the New Testament. It would have been great, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It would have made a big difference. It did.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. No, well said. I mean, as I forgot who said it, a scholar said, the debate on Thomas is going to go on probably after you and I are gone, Darren, or we're punishing our next manifestation in another Love and Rocket song. But the truth is that the Jesus in the Gospel of Thomas doesn't die for our sins or anything. He's bringing secret information, is the same Jesus as the Sethians or the Valentinians. So there is something very different from Thomas that's closer to the Gnostic as far as Jesus. They're both saying the world's an illusion, wake up, here is the secret information that I am imparting, whether it's Jesus, Hermes, those ancient mystery teachers that we don't even know if they're real, right? Like Hermes.
That's right. Yes, these composite figures are made up of different gods and teachers and masters. Yeah. But of course, no. Thomas is of course more of a in the Gospel of Thomas. Christ is more of a teacher, of a sort of spiritual teacher, of a master, of a communicator of secret knowledge. And it definitely has a very different. The whole.
He's also our higher self. He could just be Thomas's daemon, right?
Judas. That's Thomas. Right. That's right. Yeah.
We don't know, but he could be just Thomas having a. Thomas did some drugs and is like, dude, this high, my higher self speaking to me, dude.
but the point I'm trying to make is that it definitely has something very particular and Gnostic about it, no doubt. But it could easily be read by. A mainstream Christian, I think, without that mainstream Christian having to feel that this is, heretic or non-accepted or whatever. Whereas, for example, in the Origin of the World, give that to a mainstream Christian and they'll just jump out the window. But the Gospel of Thomas, I think, has that. It transcends. It definitely is a Gnostic text from my point. From my perspective, my humble perspective, and I think that, I agree with what you said, and I definitely agree with what David Brackey says. It's a Gnostic text in its own, a very particular sui generis form of Gnosticism. But it could be read by it transcends the labels. If you see what I mean, I think it's a wonderful, beautiful text. Reminds me of. These Japanese koans, these you know, from the Rinzai tradition, these riddles that are trying to awaken you and take you away from the limits of language, which is again going back to Baudrillard and the postmodernists. It's language, the way we relate to reality through language, but language is at the same time a prison for us. You know, it's like this old famous painting, you know, that this is not a pipe. You know, and there's a painting of a pipe. But I mean, it isn't a pipe, but it is a pipe at the same time. And then what is a pipe in the end? And that's the problem we've got, I think, that reality is such a it's just is it consensual? Is it where do we how can we be sure that we are seeing that our language and the way that we relate to the world is providing us with a real perspective of reality? You know, it sounds a bit long-winded and silly, but you know, and I think, well, again, I mean, the power of language, I mean, a bit slightly unrelated to this, but William Burroughs, he said language is a virus. And of course it's you know, and it mutates, and of course all these words and symbols that we use, they mutate, and eventually they lose complete relation to the original subject. And in a way, it's I suppose it's how far we've got ourselves lost from the true God, from the higher God, from the God above God, as you always say in your program.
Well, that was Paul Tillich. It was an Orthodox theologian who came up with that cool concept, which I borrow. But no, that's really well said, and you're right. I mean, there was a reason, as some have said, scholars said, that Jung loved the Gnostics and he didn't really care for the Neoplatonists because he thought the Gnostics had this repository of rich symbols and ideas that it could use that later became alchemy. And his language, you're right, 100% there. And I mean, like Justin Sledge has said, the Gnostics were masters at language and came from this Hebrew tradition where words have different meanings and levels, and you use different puns. As he said, the Valentinians were using Hebrew and Aramaic puns in a time when both languages were dying. I mean, Philo of Alexandria didn't know Hebrew, but the Sethians and the Valentinians are using it. And like you said, they're using it in a way where you can read it many ways. It's kind of be confusing. They're playing a joke on you because it's parody, you know, in many ways. And that's, I think, part of the genius of the Gnostics, which again, people love, like Sledge and Jung and all that, was their way of playing with these symbols that, as you said, remain alive as reality decays. And the simulation is part of it. One thinker said, simulation theory might be the only time in history where theists and atheists can finally agree on something and work together, because it's a simulation. And that I agree with 100%. Or who did that? David Pierce. I have the quote here. The simulation argument is perhaps the first interesting argument for the existence of a creator in 2000 years. And he's right. So again, this goes right back to the Gnostics and their ideas of a simulation.
It's just incredible how even if you go back to the 40s, slightly changing topic, but we go back to the 40s with or slightly before that with Hans Jonas, and he's offering us really an Gnosticism, but really an existential perspective on Gnosticism, you know, precisely focusing really on the problems of this hostile world, of this fake reality, of this dark world where we have to seek for this light. And as I say, I mean, I keep repeating myself, but it never ceases to surprise me how Gnosticism can merge, adapt, infiltrate, kidnap all these different fields of inquiry, and you know, it's incredible that having been prescribed and you know, the original Gnostic groups from the first, second, and third century have been disappeared, and if we consider the Cathars to be Gnostic, which I think they probably were, but again, I'm just a layman. We're looking at where they were exterminated by the last one of these you know, European crusades. It's incredible that today in 2024 we're still talking and debating the work of the Gnostics. It really is. It's incredible. There's obviously something of great value there.
Oh yeah, you should see the rite. The rite has either appropriated the idea of the archons and all that, or they're once again trying to blame all the world's problems on the Gnostics. So it's wonderful. I love it. And yeah, going back to the Gospel of Thomas, thinking you're right. Yeah, Thomas, unlike on the Origin of the World or Secret Book of John, it's got the Gnosticism without the Lovecraft monsters and the existentialist dread of Hans Jonas. But I want that. I want to be like Thomas says, first you will be disturbed, then you'll be amazed. I want to be challenged. But some people, okay, enjoy these nice little sayings, and they're very Eastern and very meditative. Yeah, have some fun. If you're not ready to see the truth that this is a world of horror, that's fine. But again, that's the whole point. It's like, you know, I can love the world and hate it at the same time, just as you, Darren, have solar and lunar powers. There's nothing wrong with embracing the horror, as because that way you embrace the holiness as well.
I think that Monday to Friday, we have to do our best to embrace, you know, the joy and the happiness, or we'll just fall apart, because we have to, you know, work on top of it. I think we can enjoy the not enjoy, because that's obviously the wrong word, but we can delve in the darkness and understand the darkness in our own time. I mean, what I'm trying to say with this is that I think we do need or most of us, I think, as humans, and this is why religions, mainstream religions, are successful, I think, to a degree, is you know, something that lifts us up and that keeps us going and that gives us a bit of hope, even if it's false hope. But of course, that's the other thing about Gnosticism, that, you know, I remember there was an interview you did with Tobias Chirden not very long ago, and Tobias Chirden was saying, you know, that, you know, you can't be living in a, you know, you can't be following an ideology where the whole world, with this, you know, extreme dualism, where the whole material world is just horrible and wrong and a delusion, because then you think about, well, you know, we've got, what about our children and our cat and our, you know, whatever, you know, the there is beauty in this world. And of course there is beauty. And this is, you know, the title of my book, The Divine Spark. Mm-hmm. The divine spark that's been left behind by Sophia in the, you know, in the creation myth, or the Gnostic myth. Sorry. And I do think that by accepting, by following an ideology or a philosophy or a school of thought like Gnosticism, where you learn to accept that there is this incredible darkness, that this world has been built on blood and pain, that, you know, it's, you know, we've become totally accustomed to it, you know, but it's it is a world of horror. And of course, how could this have been created by a perfect, loving God? And I think this is one of the other great successes of Gnosticism, is the way that it resolves the problem of evil, of theodicy. Because of course, if this is a world that's been created by a false God, then of course, you know, things make sense. But still, yet that false God still has something in him from, you know, the real God above, through all these the different change of emanations. And but even in mainstream Christianity, there's, you know, at least in Catholicism, it's always said that Satan is the prince of this earth. So in a way, I mean, you know, it's all there, really. I mean, and I think once we interiorize that, and you know, I think going back to the origin of the world, I mean, that's a sobering read. That's an incredible text. You know, a red pill moment. You eat the apple, and then you suddenly see your creators as monsters. I mean, that is just, you know, it really does. You know, it's impact. It does have an impact, doesn't it? So yeah, definitely. I mean, I think. So I do think that there's a way that we can see Gnosticism as something dreadful and dark, and that perhaps people will say, well, you know what, I'd rather follow, I don't know, Buddhism or become a Sufi or whatever, and just you know, try and look for the positive side of things. But of course, that's not what we know our human condition to be, and Gnosticism accepts fully both. I mean, of course, Buddhism does as well, with the Four Noble Truths, and suffering is the first one. And perhaps that's one of the I think commonalities that it might have with Gnosticism. But Gnosticism goes so far beyond, in that this is a world not only a delusion. It's just it's a world created by, you know, even the Archons have created the parts of our body. So it's quite. It's quite harsh and quite dark, but at the same time, there's a seed of hope at the end of it, which is, of course, what maybe Jung would call individuation, what more standard philosophers would call self-realization, what Christian mystics would call theosis, or they would call the unitive stage of mysticism, or Satori, or Nirvana, or, you know, which is this reaching with God, and as you mentioned before, with the higher self, with the transcendence, whatever we want to call it. And I think that's the positive message of Gnosticism, really, is there. I mean, it's so it's easy to see it as something dark, but then on the other hand, there is, it can easily be flipped, and you can see the good in it. And I think the Gospel of Thomas, of course, as you said, it's got this Eastern, philosophy, stroke religion feel to it, but as you also say, it's you've got Christ that's compelling you to attain this hidden knowledge, and that's always also has an impact, has a something. It's this language of riddles, where they try and take you away from the discursive language, where you're thinking, you know, you're left, well, thinking is not really, you're left feeling or seeing images or experiencing thoughts rather than having thoughts or thinking thoughts, I think.
Yeah, I want you to hold on to that, because when we get to a part of your book, I want to discuss. But yeah, you're right. I mean, yeah, there was a part, every part of your body is, there's an archon in charge. There's even in the Secret Book of John, an archon for your left and your right butt cheek. Not one archon for your ass, two archons for your ass. So that's how much care the damn you're just putting into our humanity. And I think the proof is in the pudding, Darren. You know, yes, the Gnostic works are intense throughout history, but what happened? What did people say about the Cathars, the Manichaeans, the Valentinians? That they were very happy people, they were well-rounded, they were at peace, they were kind, they were giving. Yeah, they may be talking about, you know, the God of this world and the, you know, the Satan rules the entire world, but they were very, again, they were very great people. People wanted to be around them, right?
Well, this is right. Yeah, but the Cathars, I mean, in particular, I mean, they seem to be some sort of idyllic medieval commune in a way, and they had perfect ecumenical relations with all the mainstream Christians they lived with. Well, many of them were relatives, and yeah, absolutely, they do seem very well balanced and happy individuals. Yeah, definitely. And it's just that those two examples. I mean, it's the brute dogma that destroys them both. You know, Manny gets flayed, I believe he's flayed to death, and the poor Cathars gets burnt. And you know, and I was just remembering just a moment ago that you were talking about the Rosicrucians, and there's this apocryphal story about Christine Rosengruth being the descendant of Cathars. Is that right? Or really? Have you heard about that?
No,
I've read about that somewhere, but don't ask me where, unfortunately.
Let us know if you know that in the chat or you want to Google it real quick, but could be.
Yeah.
Could be. I mean, there's a lot of legendary and who knows. But Graham, do you have a question or a comment on this discussion we're having?
Oh, no, I find it fascinating. And I think part of the issue with, Gnosticism and why it lost out to Orthodox Christianity is, Gnosticism, you accept the world light and dark. It's like, Jung's, for a tree's branches to go to heaven, the roots have to go to hell. And that's a whole lot less profitable than Orthodox Christianity. And Paul built such a strong, franchising method for it that just Gnosticism with the, it's just less profitable. That's pretty much my observation so far. Tag.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah. Who wants to go inward and do the hard work? That's where you get down and dirty when you go down into the underworld and have to face the dragon, and the dragon is just you. So it's easier just to show up on Sunday and be done with it, right?
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. Although I think that the parallelisms between the Christian mystics and I think in within the Catholic Church and possibly the Orthodox Church and all other old apostolic denominations. I think that this in mysticism where Gnosticism still prevails and lives within these established religions. And, perhaps it came from as far back as the Essenes and or the who were the early ascetic hermits, right? Weren't they? But I do think that that there is... within the main, even within the mainstream church, there is still, but you have to dig deep, and of course you have to find your own way. But I do think there is still there Gnostic ideals and practices. Even I've always thought that the Catholic Church, with all its different sacraments and its folk magic, and it's really the only mainstream magic club left, or society left, way. And of course, it's interesting because these Gnostics, they did practice, or some of them did, the Eucharist. There's this intriguing sacrament of the bridal chamber, which has sort of very sort of ancient Jewish to me, the little I know about it. And of course, there's all these, you've got Clement, you've got Origen, you've got St. Paul. I mean, I don't know what your take is on Elaine Page's book on St. Paul, but, obviously you quote a lot. I think, is it from his letter to Ephesians or something? I'm not sure. The one where he talks about powers, dominations, and, that's a very Gnostic, that's very Gnostic sounding. And it's not only because whenever I hear that, or whenever I read that, it's always, in your voice, I hear your voice saying it. You've used that wide word in your yes, but it does sound so Gnostic. And he does talk also in Corinthians, I think it is. I can't remember now which passage exactly, but he talks about hidden wisdom. So I really think that Christianity is, that's my particular interest in my sort of say niche interest in Gnosticism is how intertwined it is with Christianity, But of course, it goes beyond the boundaries of any one religion, and it's so much more. But I find it interesting how they both, one of them, I don't know who was, which one, but they bastardized each other, didn't they? And they've lived alongside, and there's there's a lot of, when you look at Clement and Origen, I think it's Origen who believed in all these different levels of spiritual attainment and these different, the worlds preceding this one and worlds that will come after. and loads of Gnostic ideas. And of course, he refuted the Gnostics, as did his master Clement. But then, on the other hand, there's Gnostic stuff in their works, in the same,
even more Gnostic than the Gnostics.
That's right.
That's wild. Right. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. I mean, they were excommunicated as well. I mean, Origen was, or was it Clement? I can't remember now. But they were excommunicated at some point. One of them was saying that even Satan would be saved in the restoration of intellectual souls, and of course, it does all sound very much like the emanations. And I mean, even in when you read, the Nicene Creed. When it talks about, begotten, not made of consubstantial, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
That really sounds like emanation language.
It is.
It does. It really does sound like emanation language. I mean, and the emanation theory or ideas, I find it as well fascinating. Fascinating because it's a very ingenious way of describing something that can't be described or that can, how do these energies, these hidden energies, or this divine spark, can travel from one higher being to a lesser being? And these two these two realms of existence. It really is fascinating. Gnosticism, it really is. And I think that that the fact that it's got I was talking about how it's intertwined with Christian. With Christianity, and I think that is true. Although, of course, the church despises Gnosticism, always has, sees it as something very dangerous. And of course, all these ancient, all these early Christians were, and again, I go back to Lane Pages, I think they're all trying to, they all had their ideas and their convictions, many of them with a very strong Gnostic flavor. But I think that they then had to sacrifice these in looking for this. Consistent, coherent, one church that they were, that was their ambition. But it's fantastic. You've got Middle Platonism in Gnosticism, in this, you've got Jewish mysticism, there's Hellenic philosophy. And as I said, nowadays we've got, I think there's a connection with the theory of simulation, with transhumanism, with all sorts of things. It's a never-ending field. I mean, I think you'll be doing this program in 100 years if you buy your immortality.
Yeah, if I turn myself into a robot or something like that. Yeah,
if you download yourself to a cloud, then you'll still be doing this.
Yeah. Or like Futurama.
You won't run out of topics, I think. That's the
No. As long as the world keeps doing what the world's gonna do, I'll find stuff. So but yeah, I would say for Paul, obviously the Gnostics were gaga over him. And then when you read, I don't know if you read the work of a Greek Orthodox scholar, David Bentley Hart, and he's done work on Paul, and he says we keep reading Paul through Sunday school glasses, but when you read them in the Greek, when you see the worldview, yes, Paul is just describing a Gnostic world. These angels have taken over the world, these powers and principalities, these archons, they're mating with women, they're destroying humanity, and only through this knowledge of this cosmic being called Christ that the Jews and the Gentiles have forgotten or don't know about, will we awake and overthrow the God of this world? So it was right there. I mean, and Paul was probably more common with early Christians and Jews at that time than people are admitting. I think that was very much the Enochian Gnostic worldview, I think, was pretty widespread in the first century. But they had to hide that. There's a few heretics getting in trouble, and Paul was always Orthodox or whatever.
But this is the issue. Of course, it's the being able to read these texts in the original language, which of course I can't do. And that's, I think, just by writing this book, where some of these words haven't come up. And I've had to translate them. Well, not I haven't translated them. I've had to look for translations, just, single words. And you realize how so many so many of these words are etymologically, their meaning is so, the root of their meaning is so different. You know, like liturgy comes from liturgia, which I'm not pronouncing it properly from the Greek, but that means service to the state, which is quite interesting, you know. And so many other words that are used in Christian texts, and of course in some of these ancient Gnostic texts, and of course all these constant translations from Coptic to Greek, and then, you know, it's I think we lose out a lot by not being able to read them in the original language. But of course, you know, it's that's not an easy feat, is it, to you know, suddenly go and learn ancient Greek and Aramaic and Copt. But definitely. And I think if we read many of these ancient texts in their original language, we would be, you know, awed and surprised.
And we also have to deprogram ourselves too, because we were raised in a certain way, society says. So we're not seeing, we're seeing how we were taught to see these people or these texts, not what they were, what the cultural context was. And once you do that, again, you see Paul completely different. You see the Gospel of Mark different. You see, you know, you see what was going on, how they saw things.
Absolutely.
But Darren, I wanted to show part of your book and get your thoughts on it and the audience's thoughts. And this is, let me read it for you, because again, your book always gives all these pointers so people can understand about what Gnosticism is. So I'm going to pull it up here and read it. This will be more space. This is from your book, and you're talking about, again, another groundbreaking book, which is Tobias Churton's book, The Gnostics from Ancient Persian to Modern Times. And you summarize, for the Gnostics, salvation is achieved through secret knowledge consisting in understanding the Gnostic myth of the fall and freeing oneself from the material world to reach the true God, who then sends the Logos, Jesus, to free us. But this Jesus is not the same Jesus of the official church, as we have previously pointed out. The cosmos and the human body are a source of doubt and skepticism. The cosmos and creation are the products and emanations of the aeons. And I like how in your book you do say that aeons are both a time, a place, and a consciousness. People always miss that one, but that is so important to know. Three, yep. The Gnostics use complex rituals and magical or theurgical ceremony, possibly influenced by the ancient mysteries in which women could fully participate. That's important. Four, humanity is divided into pneumatikoi, or spiritual beings who have received gnosis, psychikoi, who are believers in gnosis, but must work on their morality to reach gnosis, or as Robert Price calls them, the pew potatoes. And then the hyliko, who only know the world of matter. That's, yeah, Conan the Barbarian and those characters. So I think that's, and here, of course, you're right. Yeah, the aeons are celestial beings who are also units of space and time. They are invisible, spiritual, eternal entities that dwell in plenitude. I think that's important because that's part of the koan. That is so hard to, but the Mandeans believe that today. It's easy, but for us, well, there is a secret on the other side if you believe that. So that's what I think it's good. And I like how you add about the mysteries, because even a lot of these books, like, again, we're talking about, that come out 10 years ago, 15 years ago, they don't really talk about how important altered states of mind are and how the experience is far more. Even Jung said, experiencing the symbol is more important than deciphering it. Don't sit there and go, well, this means that the elite are taking over the country. No. Experience it. That's what opens your mind. And the Gnostics were about, and you quote David Brackey, they were about these astral flights. They were shamanistic. They were the shamanistic side of any religion. And that's finally, it's happening. And the other one, of course, that I say is that more and more Gnosticism was an ancient, it comes from the ancient mysteries. It did not sprout out of Christianity. It's older. So again, I'm glad your book addresses this.
I mean, I think that all mysticism points out to a reality beyond words. And I think that's, you know, you you've mentioned Young, you've mentioned all these different authors and groups. It's funny you mentioned the Mandaeans, because I wanted to write about the Mandaeans, because obviously being the only group in existence today, but I just thought that would be a disservice. It would be very difficult to, ideally it would have been great to find the Mandaean and interview him for the book, perhaps next time. I think that's fascinating. I mean, they still exist today. And practice their rituals, which takes me to the other point. I mean, it'd be one of the things about Gnosticism is that it's very difficult to practice, in a sense. It hasn't become. I mean, I know in the States you have Stephen Hoeller, and you've got loads and loads of Gnostic groups and churches and so on. Closest thing we've got here in the UK, I believe, is the French Gnostic churches. But it's not something that's easy to come across, and then of course that's taking me to the thought that Gnosticism is it demands us to find our own practice.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And
I think that it is a solitary practice in a way. And I do think that, again, I mean, we look at Evagrius Ponticus, this Christian hermit that was a practitioner of hesychasm. Mm-hmm. And he has some, he was a follower of Origen. And he has quite a lot of Gnostic ideas. And I think I'm right in saying that the Dead Sea Scrolls and also the Nag Hammadi codices were most probably left in those places, hidden and concealed by Christian monks. So I find it very interesting. And I think hesychasm or hesychia or forms of meditation, and again, altered states of consciousness, of course, we can look at Sir Philip K. Dick and his work, and it's an essential part of Gnosticism, because it's the experience, and it's difficult to write about experiences and breaking down an experience. I mean, it's like this French occultist André Nataf said, to name a thing is to destroy it. And that's the thing, isn't it? I like very much what April de Koninck says. She says she refers to Gnosticism as a metaphysical orientation, I think, or inclination.
Correct.
And I find that fascinating. I think that's a very, very good definition. And that's why I hold on to when I try to explain to somebody what Gnosticism is, when they ask me, what's this about? What's Gnosticism? And I try to explain, well, it's not a religion. It's not a philosophy. It's not science. It's not an ancient mystery religion. But yet, in a way, it's all of these things at the same time, which is its strength.
Yeah, it's like I tell people, it's like shamanism. There's no church of shamanism. It's a spiritual modality that appears across all civilizations and time. And like you said, when you start studying shamanism, you're like, God damn, I don't want to be the shaman. Because, yeah, the shaman was the spiritual troubleshooter. But he was the shrink of the tribe. He was the medicine man. He was officiating weddings. He was writing philosophy and history for the tribe. So he was all over the map, but his overall thing was to make sure that the tribe was healthy, spiritually, physically, and mythologically, that it had a purpose, because again, the tribe would be looking up at the sky and like, oh my God, we're so screwed. Look at this giant universe. And the shaman's like, no, no, no. We got these myths, and I'm going to go to the spiritual world, and we all have a purpose. And the tribe would be like, oh God, yeah, yeah, yeah. Something like that.
So. I like that. Yes, absolutely. I really like that.
Hey, shining crazy diamonds. Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill Cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten, and the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
Economics, Reaganomics, word control, the sound of